They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise me.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hey, welcome to Who Shot Ya? It's your boy. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio, as always, film critic, host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast. It's Sometimes It Snows in April, April Wolf. April, what is good with you?
Hi. Okay, so in keeping with like the theme of what we're going to have on the show, which is just like white people. Like cracker culture.
Whitey whiteness.
I want to say that like what's good with me is a Billy Joel interview that I just read.
Oh, that was a good one.
It is a good interview and it is hilarious. And it's just, I don't know how you guys feel about him. I have like this weird soft spot for his music.
I enjoy Billy Joel.
I had a handful of songs, yeah.
Yeah, like I remember... like for the longest time was like playing in a supermarket once, like right after Trump won, and I heard someone singing in the aisles like back to me as I was singing it loud, like in a grocery store, and it was just like, ah, oh, it's a uniting force, Billy Joel. And anyway, so this interview is hilarious, and there's one section where he's like, you know, when I'm done, what I'm going to do is like have my stage when I'm performing be like a living room with a couch, and it's just going to be like a remote control, and the stage is going to be like plexiglass in between me and the audience, and instead of playing anything, I'm just going to get up and sit down in the couch and pick up the remote control and just turn it on and then do nothing and wait until people start throwing shit. Like, that's how he wants to end his career. It's just like watching the television of people like hating him and rioting in an audience. Yeah. I was like, well, Billy Joel.
Show world. But for him, just watching television.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
He's punk after all.
Yeah. I know. I was just like, is he punk? But then the beginning of the interview was just like him watching his wife take a helicopter to the grocery store. And I was like, I don't know.
So, yeah. Oh, a grocery helicopter. We all need one, though. Mm. We all need one, though. Oh, to my right, he's the film reviews editor at The Rep. He is el mero mero de Navidad, people. The one and only Mr. Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what is good with you? Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. What's good with me is I'm reading again.
Oh,
I've been very lax about that of late, but I've been sort of making myself read more because it turns out it's fundamental. And I am almost now finished with James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Oh, shit.
And it's really good. I mean, I'm not like surprised because, I mean, he's great, but I had just never read this one. And it's much like the horrible movie that we're seeing today. It's all set over one day, but with a lot of flashbacks. And you get to know sort of the backstory of all these different characters and how they come to where they are in their lives. And just beautiful writing and, you know, lots of essential things to say about race and religion and sexuality. And I mean, James Baldwin is just the shit. So, go read him.
That's what's up, yo. That's what's up. Mm-hmm. And ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest in the building. I mean, he's a staple here at Max Fun, if I may say so. Dare I say, he's the host of International Waters.
True.
You can find his fantastic writings. Read him on Esquire.com. My man, don't show up to a pool party at this dude's place wearing jeans, because I believe that's how we first met, and I was like, I feel like such a dummy right now.
Well,
ladies and gentlemen, it's Mr. Dave Holmes.
Ricky.
Dave.
Hey, bro.
What's up? Dave.
It's not just my pool parties that you want to not show up in jeans to. It's all, kind of all of them.
By definition,
non-jeans affair.
I don't like to throw my friends under the bus, but I'm going to throw Matt Bronger on the bus.
Yeah, I think that's smart.
I'm going to throw him under the bus.
I think that's smart.
I put it on him.
He didn't warn you about the pool.
He didn't really give me like the full details.
Yeah, well.
Dave, what's good with you, sir?
What's good with me? I am doing the opposite of what Alonzo was doing. It just hit me. Like, every few months it hits me that, like, there's an internet and you can just find anything on it. So, the other night, it was late at night, and I was like, I wonder if I could watch the US Festival from 1983. Well, guess what? You can. You can. You can go to YouTube. It's mostly on there. So I will spend a whole night watching, like, Missing Persons set from the US Festival.
What's the US Festival?
It was like an early Coachella.
It was like after Woodstock and before Live Aid. Yeah. It was the US Festival.
2 and 83.
Okay.
Did Laura Branigan play? Or?
No. There was no place for her. There was a New Wave Day. There was a Hard Rock Day.
Ooh.
And then there was, I think, just like a regular rock day. So there's like, you know, you get your Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Get
your Berlin.
You get your Berlin. Amazing. Their version of Sex from the US Festival will blow your goddamn mind.
That's what's up.
There's Stevie Nicks doing solo material.
Word.
It's fantastic. And it's at some speedway or something somewhere. It's just pure and beautiful. A Richard Blade with like tall tube socks comes out and introduces the bands.
All right.
Then somebody else comes out afterwards and is like, oh, I need to talk to you about shuttle buses. Because it's like back to where the cars are. So it feels prehistoric and it's fantastic and it's just like a great little escape. And I feel like if I keep watching, then maybe I'll just open the door and it'll be 1983. And we can do things differently.
That is peak early 80s. Yeah. Definitely. Ricky, what's good?
Oh, damn it. I actually had it this time. It's just that he beat me to it.
Too slow.
Oh, I'll tell you what's good with me, y'all. It's U-God, Meth, Inspector Deck, Master Killer, the RZA, the Jizza, Dirty Bastard. I will be going to see the Wu-Tang Clan this Friday night.
Ooh.
I kind of figured from the introduction.
It will be all the original members minus ODB. Mm-hmm. Respect. They will be playing at the Shrine. They will be playing the entire Enter the 36 Chambers album, top to bottom. And I am so goddamn hyped for this, y'all. I am so goddamn hyped for
this. It's got to be super sold out, right?
I mean, I feel like it was sold out, and then today's shit was like, yo, we're super sold out, dog.
Oh, really?
Super sold out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I've never been to this location before, but yeah. I'm just fucking hyped.
I just went for My Bloody Valentine.
Sunday night.
Oh, Lord.
And what?
That's a band that causes actual damage.
Yeah, my hair moved. That's how loud it was.
Like Dave White, who destroyed his hearing going to punk rock shows in his teen years, and like listens to like the loudest, most frenzied, horrifying noises ever, has to walk outside when they get to their like 20-minute encore of, I Can Only Imagine?
I don't know.
I Can Only Realize. I forgot the name of this song, but it's like louder than airplanes landing.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's unbroken many sound equipment.
Yeah, like you can go outside and still hear it.
Oh, yeah. You need to protect your ears.
Alonzo, you're such an old man. It's great.
It's true.
But you'll like the venue. It'll be great.
Hey, on today's episode, we are going to be talking about Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. then we have a special guest, Yale professor and historian Tavia Nyong'o will join us by phone to talk about a new film series called BAM Cinematheque and the Racial Imaginary Institute on Whiteness. And as always, we will have staff picks. But first, it's time for our news roundup game called It A Dick, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Here's how it works. We're all going to read a news headline, and any one of us will jump in with our take by answering these two questions. Is this important, and do I care?
I want you to know, a friend of mine on Facebook said, my new rule for reading political news on Facebook is the Ricky Carmona rule. Is this important? Do I care?
That's what's up. Shout out to that person. Shout out to that person. So let's start off with this big one. This was like a huge story. Last week, director James Gunn was fired from Guardians of the Galaxy 3 after some decade-old tweets were unearthed by Fox News. The tweets were meant to be jokes, but dealt with sensitive subject matter like pedophilia, rape, and Holocaust. Gunn has apologized. He says he accepts Disney's decision. Many of the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy have been vocal in their support of Gunn. Selma Blair, Lloyd Kaufman. There's even a change.org petition that has 270,000 signatures to get him rehired. Is this important to y'all? Do you care?
It is, in that we're going to have to, like, this is the moment where we find out and figure out as a culture what we're going to do about the dumb things that we tweeted 10 years ago. Because everyone said something stupid. Everyone said something hateful. Everybody said something that, like, that they're ashamed of now.
Seemed funny at the time.
Funny at the time, or was even maybe reflective of how you felt at the time or whatever. Now there's an internet, and you put that stuff out there, and it lives forever. Even if you delete it, it'll still exist somewhere. So everybody's probably got something, you know. His was especially, you know, kind of gross. But there's a 0% chance Disney didn't know about it before they hired him in the first place. It's just a, it's a, it is for me, it feels like a retribution for what happened to Roseanne Barr. Mm-hmm. And I think there are just these unhinged, like, internet personality, you know, Mike Cernovich or whatever the hell his name is.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Who just, like, their whole life is trying to do this thing. Like, be, you know,
trolling.
Fight for their side. Troll, essentially. Yeah. Fight for their side in dumb ways on the internet. And they got, you know, they got an important figure.
Yeah.
You know? I will not be surprised if Disney walks this one back, frankly, because...
And rehires him?
Yeah.
Really?
Because Cernovich did the same thing to Sam Stein at MSNBC. And then within a week, I think, MSNBC realized, oh, this is the guy who says date rape doesn't exist. And he's now clutching his pearls and pretending to be offended by anything. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, no, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, he's a bad faith fascist.
Yeah.
yeah, essentially. Bad,
yeah. So we just kind of have to, like, we got to figure out what our, like, entertainment industry policy is on that kind of thing. Yeah. And this is maybe where we find that line.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all gross. I hate it. Joke about rape and pedophilia.
The tweets are indefensible, but the context by which this has all been dredged up, a thing that he's already apologized for, a thing that Disney certainly knew about, is because this guy is basically being a troll. And as somebody pointed out, the difference between him and Roseanne is that jokes about pedophilia are not pedophilia, but jokes about racism are racism.
Yeah. And jokes from 10 years ago are jokes from 10 years ago. Jokes now are jokes now.
That's like the bad faith thing. The thing that I don't understand is just like Ted Cruz is like, he's a pedophile. Like fucking Ted Cruz, well, he's just like he said he's a pedophile, so he's a pedophile. And it's, I haven't seen the tweets and I haven't seen the blog posts, some of which are like my friend Linnell said that one of them is like him talking about masturbating in front of like a preteen girl or something like that, and just like really terrible bad taste shit that. Mm-hmm. Would not fly, you know, at all today, obviously. Yeah. So I don't truly know what any of it is, but I don't. It's all such a fucking mess. I just don't want to do what Nazis tell us to do, like, or do it because Nazis told us to do something. That's my big sticking point, you know.
Yeah. April, do you want to read this?
I will. Yeah, I just looked at what it was. Okay, so more Comic-Con news. For those who are still shaken by the end of Infinity War, Marvel is here to help. At this year's Comic-Con, Marvel provided a grief counseling booth for those still affected by the end of the movie. And inside the booth was an actor portraying a therapist, motivational posters and that said things like, "We are Groot and you are stronger than vibranium," the opportunity to hug a giant Hulk, donuts, and the chance to watch a deleted scene from the movie. Is this important? Do you care?
I want to hug a Hulk.
I'm always down for hugging a Hulk.
What about the Hulk?
I would give the Hulk.
That
a
racist
hug.
Son of a bitch.
is the Hulk
Wait,
racist?
Wait, is it Hulk Hogan?
Yeah.
The Incredible Hulk.
Sorry, you said any Hulk. I'm sorry, any Hulk.
No, you right.
I picked a Hulk.
You did.
We stand corrected.
It was a trick question.
It could be Eric Bana or Mark Ruffalo. Lou Ferrigno, even. You know.
I love the idea of just like. Yeah, like little like grief counseling booths outside a movie. If you thought that movie was horrible, I would love to like go out and like somebody consoles me. Because hey, Back to the Future 3, you're right, Ricky, it was a piece of shit. Come here, we'll take care of you right now. Uh-huh. That would be fantastic.
Yeah,
I'd be all for
it's
that.
It's the opposite of like that William Castle thing where there was a movie where everybody who went in the theater was supposedly insured against death by fright, and then there was a moment where you could leave the theater if you were too afraid. But then they didn't want to encourage people to like get their money back, so to leave the theater, you had to like be bathed in this yellow light while a voice said, "Look at the coward going to the coward's corner,"
wow.
And then a fake nurse would like take your blood pressure. It was a whole thing.
What movie was this?
It was like Homicidal, I think. One of the William Castle movies.
I like that.
Do you remember the movie Tender Flesh? It was called something else. It was like Blood Beach or something Beach, but they it was re-released as Tender Flesh, and I will never get the poster or the TV or the newspaper ad out of my head. It was like a silhouette of like a woman running, and there was a warning that said, when the heroine of this movie opens the refrigerator, we cannot be held responsible for the fright, for the level of fright. So just no going in. And it was like fully like...
The cottage cheese has gone bad.
Yeah. I was in first grade and I was just like, something terrible is happening in that movie. And people are... They made it and people are going to see it. This is a terrifying world.
Did you ever find out?
Never really did.
Oh my God.
Never really did.
Oh, well, you know, here's a new story for April Wolf, yo. Ooh. The film version of the musical Cats is underway. Calm down, April. Keep it together. This week, they announced a few members of the cast, which include Jennifer Hudson, Taylor Swift, James Corden, and Ian McKellen. The film will be directed by Tom Hooper, who helmed The King's Speech.
And
Exactly.
And Les Miserables. Who's going to play Rum Rum Tugger and Old Deuteronomy? We are unable to say at this time. Is this important? Do you care?
This cat's cast. Oh my God!
You know, Ian McKellen's all like, I've always wanted to work with Taylor Swift.
Yeah. And like James Corden, it just feels like that's like he just comes with the deal. You know,
yes.
What I mean?
Yes.
Like it just makes perfect sense that he would be in it, yeah. Even though you don't really want to see him in it.
He was like standing in the corner when they sign it, and they're like, "Oh, yeah. Is he? Oh, he's.
Oh, yeah. Let's get him in there.
Yeah, oh, you're already here. Okay. Well, then I guess we might as well. Yeah.
So who's Grisabella then? Is it Hudson or Swift?
I don't know. I mean, they're both kind of young. Maybe Jennifer Hudson. I don't know.
This is a lot with makeup these days.
I do not like this musical. It has one good song.
It's pretty rough.
Which one do you think is the good song?
Memory.
Okay. I just didn't know if that was too played out for you.
Well, I mean, it's not on my iTunes or anything, but I'm thinking objectively it's a good song.
I auditioned for a high school musical singing Memory.
Did you get it?
No.
Oh, well.
That was a terrible choice to sing to audition for a high school musical.
There's a funny gag in Kevin Smith's Jersey Girl, an oft-maligned film, which if you see the director's cut is a million times better than the release version. I'm still waiting for a Blu-ray. Anyway, there's a joke where there's the kids' class has a talent show, and you have to perform with one of your parents, and every kid in the class does Memory with their like mom,
yes,
in the Cats outfit, and then they come to the Ben Affleck's daughter, and the two of them do God That's Good from Sweeney Todd.
Oh,
and she
God.
Like slashes his throat and like, yeah, you know, sends him down the chute. It's great.
That's a good scene. I like this concept, but I'm not a huge Cats fan, FYI.
Oh, okay. All right, well, now we know.
Let people, I love the costumes. Oh my God.
Now and forever.
The makeup amazing.
So good.
And I mean, get a Tom Hooper involved.
I would
rather Toby Hooper than Tom Hooper, because Les Miserables is one of the worst musicals ever. The movie, at least.
Yeah.
I know what you're asking yourselves out there. I mean, please don't let this be the end of musical talk. Oh, it ain't, y'all. It ain't. When we come back, we will be talking Mamma Mia 2. Here we go again. You're listening to Who Shot Ya.
Rolling. The news today is terrible, so why not forget about it while listening to Jonah Radio with Cash Hartzell.
Hey, everybody.
Featuring Neil Mahoney.
Also me.
This is a podcast where we play music submitted by a listener. We hang out, we listen to new tunes, and we take submissions at JonahRadio, RAYDIO, @gmail.com. Come and check us out. We're here anyway.
Yeah, we'll be here.
So, and that's it. Back to your regularly scheduled podcast. God, I hope this one goes.
Welcome back to Hoot Shout Ya. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are
April Wolf,
Dave Holmes,
Alonzo Duraldi.
Dave, my man, since you are our guest here, can
yes,
you give us, please, a brief synopsis of Mamma Mia 2? Here we go.
Okay. No. I saw it. I saw it on Saturday. I loved it.
Okay.
But what happens in it, I honestly couldn't tell you.
Okay.
It is, okay, so it is a movie... In which...
So, you're right so far. It was a movie.
It was definitely a movie.
People showed up.
So, yeah. It's It's a lot of the people from the first Mamma Mia, in which a young woman tries to. It's like Lace.
Oh, let's not go down
reverse.
That rabbit hole. For God's sake.
Well, I mean, very quickly, like there are three men that Meryl Streep, who is her mother, slept with, and one of them is her father, and she's getting married, and she wants to know which one the father is, and you never really find out, and they're ABBA songs. Oh. So in the second one, it's in the future, but also the past. Mm-hmm. 10 years later after the first one, but also like 20 years before the first one, because we go back to the '70s for '70s versions of Meryl Streep and Christine Baranski and Julie
Thank
Walters.
God. Yes.
Yes. And can we spoil? It's long
yes.
enough out that we can spoil.
Yeah, I think
so.
It's
Meryl
fine
has
to
passed,
spoil it.
And right. so it is the daughter is now in charge of the hotel on this mystical island somewhere in Greece or mm-hmm. Croatia, and she's turned it into a hotel, which maybe it already was in the first place, and she's having a big grand opening, and she wants it to be real special for her mom, and that's it.
That's
right. And that's, there are, and also there are ABBA songs
and then the ABBA songs yeah. start playing and Cher and Andy Garcia.
Yeah, so we get younger versions of all the older cast. And then really nothing happens except crazy like Pottery Barn wish fulfillment, just heaps of saffron rice and tapestries and throw pillows and porticos and shit.
Oh yeah,
it's great. It was the most fun I've had in the movies since the last Mamma Mia.
Well, before we get started and we all share our opinions here, let's listen to a clip from The Onion. The Onion reviewed this movie. Let's see what they have to say. Some of you may agree with it.
This is Peter Rosenthal, head film critic for The Onion. Today, I'll be discussing Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, a sequel to the 2008 jukebox musical Mamma Mia, and a film which you can either choose to enjoy for the perfectly fine piece of entertainment it is, or live out the rest of your existence as a miserable killjoy who slogs through life, recoiling at anything remotely joyful or upbeat in the world. Your choice.
I think I'm the killjoy he's
me
talking
too,
about.
Me
I
too.
I think I'm the killjoy, dog.
It's
yes.
not just you two.
Oh.
So you weren't into it.
Oh God,
Dave, I've been negatively looking forward to watching this movie.
Yeah,
I think dread is the word.
Dread
you
is yeah, judge. I mean,
but he really softened the blow with negatively.
Just well, keeping it
like,
upbeat.
Yeah, like nothing in this movie is like, oh, word. Now I see where they're trying to like hit with something that Ricky might be interested in. Other than like, oh, damn, there's Andy Garcia.
Yeah.
Whoa, Andy Garcia's in here. And I mean, like when Andy Garcia like finally does get like his like moment to shine and like sings what's the ABBA song?
Fernando.
Yeah. Like at that point, like we find out Cher and him have like a relationship,
Y'all are spoiling that thing, by the way.
I'm spoiling. I have zero sympathy.
Cares?
Exactly.
You can't. This movie came spoiled.
You saw it.
That's like they bury that so far at the end of the movie.
Yeah, like when Cher finally shows up in the last 15 minutes, I was like, oh, okay, she can sing and she's a cartoon, she's perfect for this. Where's she been for the last hour and 45 minutes
performing
of my life?
In Las Vegas.
Yeah. You know, and then when dead Meryl shows up and sings why do we say My Love, My Life, I actually got a little moved. And I was like, okay, here, finally, in the final moments of this two-hour nightmare is what this movie might have actually been for the rest of its running time.
I love this movie.
But instead... Yeah.
Good. Ugh. The fault lines are clearly drawn.
Right down the middle, dude. Right down the middle.
Yeah, it's the most fun.
I watched it also with film critic Katie Walsh from Chicago Tribune and LA Times and all that. And we were applauding out loud. We were like screaming. And it was just so fun to know what is coming and to also be like, this is just delightful.
Yeah.
It is the IKEA catalog of films where you just want to flip through it and be like, that's really beautiful. You know?
Look, I watch Hallmark Christmas movies, which
I know.
Which I can could tune into at any point in the plot, 20 minutes in, 45 minutes in, an hour and 50 minutes in, I knew exactly what has happened and what will happen. So I get the appeal of that sort of thing. This movie is such a histrionic shit show of, like, terrible cover songs performed badly and performed with a, like, anytime they can indicate a thing that is being mentioned in the lyrics. Yeah. Like, we're going to go to a restaurant in Paris where the maitre d' dresses like Napoleon. Why does he dress like Napoleon? So they can sing Waterloo, and when they get to the Napoleon Did Surrender part, that guy can be on screen. And
loved
it's that
it.
For 2 hours!
Yes. Loved it so much. It made me feel like I was watching The Monkees. And
yes.
I was just so excited because I was such a huge fan of The Monkees.
The shit at the wall? Those kind
Stop.
Of movies?
The shitty version of The Monkees?
Now, at this point, I'm just only looking at Dave and like just eye contact, like right here. So I felt like I was watching The Monkees. Mm-hmm. And there's even one adorable part where you've got like the heads of the two characters pop up underneath like the serving trays, and they're
oh,
like,
yeah.
"Oh!" And it's just so fucking adorable. I want to squeeze it and hug it.
Me too. God. Me too. Yeah. I mean, I just really it. Okay. It was. It's like the thing in movies where when someone like walks into an elegant bedroom or something, and they flop down on the bed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Or someone's cleaning a room and they find a wonderful dress that they wish they could afford, and they press it to themselves and twirl and twirl. Things like that that only happen in movies and never have once happened in real life. Mamma Mia is just those, and that is where it starts, and it goes up from there.
But look,
just ridiculous expressions
in general,
of fake joy.
Musicals in general operate on that level of fantasy, on that level of, no, of course, if you're walking down the streets of the Champs-Élysées, like, everyone doesn't immediately fall into, you know, like, rhythmic practiced choreography. You know, that's part of the magic of movie musicals. But this movie is so lead-footed. I mean, granted, it's better than the first one, which was even worse because it was directed by the person who directed the West End version and did that thing where when theater directors make their first movie and they have everybody like emote to the back balcony when the camera is 6 inches away from them. Mm. So, I mean, at least this time there was a bit more, there was more sort of cinematic stuff in terms of like the way that scenes would fade from like the present to the past and that kind of stuff. Mm. But just... It made me want to grit my teeth the way they were butchering these fun songs and overdoing them and just...
You can overdo an ABBA song?
Yeah,
that's
as
real,
turns out, yes, you can.
I just want to be Alonso's hype man during all this. I was like, I'm going to be too hard in the movie and Alonso's coming in.
I loved it. And I feel like every year they should do the Eurovision Song Contest and then go one further and take 20 of those songs and just make a Mamma Mia-esque movie.
Yes, yes.
You know, like
also
a jukebox
Eurovision
musical.
Fan. Yeah, yeah.
What was,
exactly.
What was the phenomena with ABBA? Like, I also just think they're horrible. Like, I think
okay, now
songs,
you're in front. Now you're...
Oh, shit. He crossed the line.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
No,
I can't. It's, don't say another
it's
word.
It's just not good. Like, when people are like, I hate disco... And they, like, say they hate ABBA. I go, okay,
wait,
fine.
Who,
I will give you that.
Where is the Venn diagram of people who hate disco and also hate ABBA? Show me this one person.
I think it's out there.
I think it's out there. But I
oh,
also
wait, go,
fucking...
sorry. But I got that backwards. Because if you love disco, you also love ABBA. If
yes.
you hate both, then you're dead to me anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah. But I love disco. But I hate. But I like.
But ABBA's
I don't need to hear
disco.
And it's not.
No.
They have Dancing Queen, which
could be, you know, you could say that that's a disco song, but overall, no.
Yeah.
No, I think it's just more like...
ABBA kicked off the tradition of, like, brilliant Swedish pop created in Swedish pop laboratories, which is, like, what all of Britney Spears and, like, all the boy bands of the early 90s, like, their entire careers were built on the work of Max Martin and his peers and the Spice Girls, too. Like, the Swedish pop laboratories have given us our great pop, and it really all began with ABBA.
I mean, you guys are asking me to, like... You know, to be down for Britney Spears now and Backstreet Boys, like that is
not
just,
all of it, like, but the good stuff.
I like two Britney Spears songs.
The good stuff comes
like
from Sweden.
Toxic is a good song. I'll throw that.
Holmes, you're the pop guy. Back me up here.
I mean, it's just perfectly executed pop music. And what you realize about ABBA in this movie is they have a lot more ballads than you remember.
Well, that's
there
the other thing.
They're a gajillion ballads.
They picked through the A material with the first movie.
But then they brought back a bunch of the A material.
And then they regurgitate Dancing Queen and a couple other ones for again. Now. But like they start digging into the kind of, you know, the not as awesome ABBA. Not that any of it's bad, but the less awesome. And then, frankly, I think left some really great ones sitting on the table. Like, okay, you have a movie where Amanda Seyfried is opening a hotel. Why don't you find something to do with The Visitors? Mm. It doesn't have to be about UFOs.
Sure.
Waterloo doesn't have to be in a French restaurant, but here we are, you know. So,
but
like,
they did The Name of the Game.
Yes.
They did Super Trooper.
Super Trooper was a great, a great addition to that.
No, they did that in the first one, too.
I didn't think they would reprise it, though, but then they bring it back so close to the end. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense. I have one quibble with this movie. Other than this one thing that I'm about to say, it was flawless. The one thing that I did not enjoy, and how spoilery can we get here? Because I want to talk about the post-credit scene.
There's a post-credit scene because I got up and walked out as soon as like it was like directed by Woo Woo. I was like, I'm
I did like the post-credit scene, actually.
Okay.
Oh, that's your quibble?
That's my quibble. obviously, Samuel L. Jackson comes in and recruits them all into the event. That's not true.
Too early.
It's not true. What happens is half the cast turns into Dustin Fletcher. That's also not true.
I'd be on board for that.
No, what happens is Colin Firth, who we learn is gay in the first one.
Yes.
There's this thing where there's like a guy who takes your tickets at the ferry or something to this
he's
wonderful.
He's like the customs agent.
And there's like he has kind of a flirty moment with the younger Colin Firth earlier. And then I forget if it's the older or the younger
there's
one.
There's a callback with Colin Firth.
It's like the same guy.
But it's like it's kind of played for laughs a little bit. Like, isn't it funny? He's gay. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't love that. That's your sticking point
for these stupid movies? I mean,
yeah.
Where's Colin Firth's boyfriend from movie one? What happened to him by the way?
Well, relationships sometimes end.
Are we supposed to think that 10 years has passed since the first movie? And also, if Meryl Streep got knocked up in 1979, that means Amanda Seyfried is playing a 39-year-old woman. And when I turned to Dave during the movie to ask about the math of what the mixture, I turned to Dave to ask about the math, and he said, nothing matters.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about this movie. It is such. Fluff is too kind. I don't even know what wispy lint that nothing has any substance whatsoever.
But that is exactly what they were trying to accomplish. And they did it so beautifully.
I guess I don't. Fluff is like that's a tight rope to walk in. Mm-hmm. I will just like check out right away if it's like that kind of like I just have zero, dude. Again, fucking Andy Garcia, cool. But even then, like his name is Cienfuegos.
Uh-huh.
Cienfuegos. It stands for 100 fires. Yeah, well, they all pronounced it Cienfuegos, which means without fire.
Oh, no.
So fucking pronounce that right. Like, okay. Get that right.
Let's not even get started on this movie's colonization of a Greek island that Amanda Seyfried has lived on her entire life, and I bet you doesn't speak a word of Greek.
And also, they had to create, like, another Greek island? Like, how white does your movie have to be? We have to make up another fucking white island that people exist on.
With
like
tons of shitty green screen at night when Cher finally shows up.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned that in my review that I enjoy like the kind of carelessness of so many casually wealthy, beautiful white people who are just like dancing amid like a bunch of, you know, ethnically ambiguous extras.
With
like
no
that
dialogue.
it's so weird that it's something that I can't help but be like, what is happening?
It's just one of those things where like, why am I here? What am I doing with this movie?
Yeah.
For the ladies and gays, Ricky. Take one for the ladies and gays.
I love movies like that, but put us in those movies as well. Like, when I see something like Pose come out, I'm like, that's what's up.
Right. Yeah.
This is involving my world. It's got motherfuckers who look like me. When it's this fucking Mamma Mia shit, and thank you, I have Andy Garcia, and then ethnically ambiguous motherfuckers in the background. Let's go get to the credits. Let's go. This isn't for me.
It's one of those things where, like, and I've talked to a lot of women of color friends of mine, too, where they do actually enjoy sometimes in the same way that I enjoy sometimes, like, because I'm very aware of whether or not a cast is all white, especially in something like this. But we almost enjoy it because we know that their lives have no problems. And it's almost like watching something where, like, oh, my God, it must feel so good to have no problems. And it's like a porn kind of thing, you know?
This movie gets, like, within 5 miles of having stakes, and then it's like, nah.
Nothing resembling a villain of any kind.
No. I mean, Cher is your villain, for real?
And, like, not.
She's like the hero.
You're giving her too much credit.
Oh, we didn't know she was going to show up. Oh, she's here, and she's totally pleasant.
Yeah.
And, like, that's... That's
she brought
as far
all
as
of
gets.
The fireworks.
She's like
her.
A little selfish, but totally
if there's a
pleasant.
Thing, if there's a thing I do unqualitatively enjoy about this movie, it's Jessica Keenan-Wynn.
She was fabulous
as the Christy Baranski mini me.
I think yes.
Like that's practically
she was great.
She's practically doing the drag version of Christy Baranski as a woman, but it was still like a delight.
Like the kind of like sneering in her voice, you know.
Well, she was in Heathers off Broadway, so
she was.
Yeah, she comes by it naturally, apparently.
I'll be damned.
And she's related to. Like Keenan Wynn.
I was wondering that.
And Ed Wynn, yeah.
We were talking about like sequels too. I mean, like a need for sequel and whether or not people needed it. And also with Equalizer 2, like these are two movies that are coming out. And also Unfriended Dark Web.
Oh, 8 of the top 10 movies right now are sequels or prequels.
So, I mean, what do we. What
that
do
are
mean?
Out right now?
That are out right now.
Yeah,
in the top 10 of the box office, 8 of them are sequels.
So, I mean, can we say anything about sequels? Because I'm really. Like, this is a weird phenomenon that.
I would care to put this in the category of unnecessary sequels, like the Dumb and Dumber sequel, not like the one
Dumb and Dumberer.
Not the Jim Carrey one where they actually
the
came
prequel,
back.
You mean?
That sequel prequel one.
Yeah. Well, I
world.
This is somewhat reductive, but he also had a point. Mark Harris from Vulture, is he Vulture? I don't forget where he is now. But anyway, the great Mark Harris wrote that because all these movies that are hits right now are sequels, that it's not about whether or not TV is better than the movies or not, but that movies have become TV in terms of we flock back for the familiar thing that we've already seen and we want to see the next installment as opposed to like, you know, gambling on something that's completely new and different.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's basically the Marvel movies are big budget episodes of their Marvel series.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. writ large.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, because like right now you've got like Incredibles 2 and you've got Ant-Man, you've got Jurassic World, Equalizer 2, Mamma Mia 2, you know.
Sicario 2.
Unfriended, you know, First Purge. So yeah, I think there is something to, you know, as much as the people who complain about this stuff on Twitter are like, oh, where are the original ideas? All these sequels and retreads, blah, blah, blah. But obviously if you are buying tickets to all those sequels and retreads and not buying tickets to like... I don't even know what my example is of a movie that didn't do well that was indeed like new and different. You know, then that's why it's happening.
Yeah, I don't ever want sequels to stop happening. Like I'm fine with sequels. It's just the when it feels like the sequels are like the main treat that we are being given during the summer. Mm. I feel like when I was a kid growing up, like it would be like, you know, X amount of big box office blockbusters. And then we're going to get The Lost Crusade as well. We're going to get another Indiana Jones movie. Holy shit. Or I think that summer we got like an Indiana Jones movie and a Ghostbusters 2 like in the same summer. And people were just like, what the fuck? This is so crazy! Yeah. It's happening!
I think even back then, though, there would be like occasional summers where like they were just this long-ass list of sequels coming out.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember because I was...
Oh, you know what? Lethal Weapon 2 came out there. So that's actually
yeah,
right. There's
I was,
this story
I was like
right
the
there.
Nerdy
that's
kid who would always read the summer preview in Time Magazine. And yeah, and it would be like, here's the 15 sequels coming out between now and Labor Day. You know?
Yeah.
So it happens.
Yeah.
But there would also be like big original things as well.
Sure.
Like you would get, you know, Con Air and The Rock and Armageddon. And
yes.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Oh, boy.
I look at that on my
you
like,
let
my
Valerian
Amazon.
Fail, and that's why you got all these sequels, people.
It's, I don't know why I just, like, I, it's been, as soon as I saw it show up on Amazon Prime, I put it in my queue, and I have, I'm like, I just look at it, I'm like, I'm never going to watch this movie.
Yeah.
This is not going
to
happen.
You had a chance to see it in 3D, IMAX, or whatever.
Yeah, that, if you were to watch it at all, it should have been big. Yeah, like on your TV, on a plane, forget it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's go around. What did we all think? Between, I mean, I think it's pretty clearly what we all got.
Yeah, right?
Should Mamma Mia 2, should we screen it, stream it, or skip it? I say skip it a lot, as much as you can. Stay mm-hmm. away. It'll give you the cooties.
Yeah, skip it early and often.
Screen it with all of your friends and a heaping bowl of saffron rice.
Yeah, yeah. I say screen it. I'm going to bring Dave with me to the next screening that I go to. I'm mm-hmm. going to see it a few times in the theater. I'm going to walk out feeling really great. And you guys have to understand, the first one I saw in the theater, like the day that someone broke up with me, and it was the only thing that made me happy, because I was like, this is exactly what I want. It's just serotonin that's just like injected straight into my fucking eyeballs.
Yep.
And, you know, I need it.
I still defend Scenes from a Mall because I saw it on the day I broke up with somebody and it spoke to me. We can't be trusted.
Screen this movie.
Screen it.
Well, that's what's up, y'all. When we are taking a break. When we come back, we got another special guest. We'll be speaking to Tavia Nyong'o about whiteness in movies. Oh, this episode is so white, y'all.
It's so white.
So white.
Is there a dog in a car at a bar on the street?
Yay! I'm Allegra Ringo, a small dog owner. My dog Pistachio howls when she's excited.
And I'm Renee Culvert, a big dog owner. My dog Tugboat tips over when he's sleepy.
And we co-host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog that airs every Tuesday. We bring you all things dog.
Yes, dog news, dog tech, dogs we met this week. We also have pretty famous guests on, but Legs. We're not going to let them talk about their projects.
No.
Just want to hear about those dogs.
We don't want to hear about your stuff, only your dogs. So join us every Tuesday on Max Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot You. Here with me in the studio are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Dave Holmes,
April Wolf.
And joining us by phone is Tavia Nyong'o, a critic and professor of American Studies at Yale University and author of the upcoming book, Afrofabulations, The Queer Drama of Black Life. Welcome, Tavia.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Tavia, we wanted to get on the phone with you because there's a film series happening right now in Brooklyn called BAM Cinematheque and the Racial Imaginary Institute on Whiteness. It's a series that examines whiteness in film, and thanks to this podcast, I've had to watch some super white films, including the one we watched this week, Mamma Mia 2, mm-hmm. Here we go again with our white ass cracker selves. I might have added that last part there. That might have been me.
No, that was the working title.
That's how I pitched it to Hollywood before. Somebody else stole my idea. Tavia, tell us a little bit about this series and how it came to be.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So the series is the brainchild of a curator at BAM and the poet Claudia Rankine, who has her Institute on the Racial Imaginary that's focused on whiteness right now. And the idea is really that whiteness is ubiquitous, but often goes unremarked upon, so that simply by calling attention to it, you can start a conversation that might be useful for us to have in this day and age. The films in the series, I like to kind of, I didn't play a role in picking the films, but I did introduce one of them, which I could talk about, White Material by Claire Denis. But the films kind of divide along two lines. There, as I like to call them, white films and films about whiteness, right? You know, so the white films are films like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or maybe You Tell Me, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Yes.
Films that are just unreflectively, unapologetically, inescapably white.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then there are films that in some ways point to and problematize the whiteness of a character or characters, right? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about the film series is that it has both of those kinds, both kinds of films.
What, can you give us an example of that second kind of film that you just mentioned there?
Well, you know, I mean, Get Out would be one that people probably know. Mm-hmm. And the one I introduced, which is White Material by Claire Denis, about a white woman living and working in Africa who refuses to leave the country, even though a civil war is descending. In the lineage of everything from the African Queen to Out of Africa, certainly, but with a much more pointed kind of post-colonial frame.
Now, the white movies that I relate to, I did consider them white movies, but growing up, I mean, I'm a child of the 80s. So Ferris Bueller's, you know, Day Off, when I was growing up, I didn't see that as a white movie. I was just like, oh, that's a great movie. You know, like I feel like there's, you tell me if I'm wrong. Now we seem to be kind of labeling these films more as white movies for those reasons that you stated. Where when I was growing up, those were just the movies that we went to go see. I just went to go see Back to the Future because that was my option.
Am I wrong in thinking that you're sort of addressing the idea of whiteness as default? Like in so much of the media, it's just this notion of like blackness is a thing or being Hispanic is a thing, but white is just in the air. It's the norm. It's the regular toothpaste, you know? Like the entire oeuvre of Woody Allen, I guess, is suffused with whiteness in this way, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a whole conversation now, right, in this era. But yeah, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, too. Definitely saw Ferris Bueller and Back to the Future. And there is a kind of unmarked default whiteness to those, those kind of iconic roles. And I think that one of the things that the film series is pointing out with, for instance, Summer of Sam, right, by Spike Lee,
yes,
a director much more known for representing Black American culture, right? What happens when someone like Spike Lee turns the camera on like a white ethnic community? Very often, we find that Black people of color, we see it in a film like Sorry to Bother You, that's on in theaters right now, just as a survival skill, have to have all these kind of observational, we can observe things about whiteness that whiteness itself may not see about itself. So I think that's what's interesting about the series is that you get a range of somewhat more self-conscious films about whiteness and just straight up critical takes, you know, by Black directors like Jordan Peele and Spike Lee.
I feel like I just want to throw it out here. I know that White Chicks is in this series, right?
Is that right?
It is.
And I was so excited when I saw that because it's just, there is a comic structure that needs to be, talked about.
Let's unpack.
It's such an amazing vehicle to get into that and to get into a host of other problems. But I just so appreciated the kind of willingness to look at a movie like White Chicks in a very critical lens.
I mean, one of the things that's been kind of fun about the series that is it's all over the map in terms of, high, low, Hollywood, avant-garde, whatever, right? Whiteness pops up in all kinds of unexpected places and all different kinds of genres. And I think it's taking, audiences to films that they would maybe not have considered, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a vehicle for, for a kind of an enlightening discussion. I think the other thing to say about White Chicks is that there's a thread that I care deeply about as like a scholar or a teacher or whatever, which is the long history of racial passing films, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Pinky is in the film
Imitation of Life.
Imitation of Life. I think it's actually not in the series, but that's a very key one, right? Mm-hmm.
Soul Man, obviously.
Human Stain.
In some ways, White Chicks is almost ripping off and parodying these, these classic tropes of a passing for white and the world that opens out to you when as a Black man or woman you get to pass into this white world. So playing off of the mystique of the border crosser, I think, is something that some of these films share.
Yeah, you just made my day. I'm just so happy that it's like a scholar was just talking to me about white chicks.
Wasn't there an 80s feature? Wasn't there an 80s feature that was basically that SNL sketch where Eddie Murphy put on white face makeup?
Oh, where he's Mr. White. Oh,
yeah. But expanded into a feature, and I can't remember now who did it. But like that was – it was essentially sort of like White Like Me, basically, where a black guy is going undercover as a white guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I think it was like a British black actor.
Yes.
Who played the role.
Adrian Lester, maybe?
I think so.
Oh, God. We'll have to go to the tape. Sorry.
I mean, this is all just everything that we're talking about, all these other movies. Is like, there could be so many extensions of this series on whiteness and in the way that we talk about it. It's such a fantastic thing that BAM is doing. I love this.
Well, yeah, because I think it's a subject that we don't talk about. But by bringing it up, you're just immediately like, oh, yeah. Oh, and then there's this. And oh, and then this other thing, too. And I mean, like, it's a thing that's always been there. But I think this is really the first time I've seen anybody kind of put a name on it.
Yeah.
Which I find really fascinating.
Can I ask you, I see that Taxi Driver is in the series as well. That's not a movie that I think of as a white movie, even though the whole cast is pretty much all white.
I guess both Taxi Driver and actually Rocky speak to, you know, let's say, like, maybe the darker side of whiteness or the darker side of white masculinity, which is this sense of being kind of embattled, needing to take back the streets. Certainly, when we think about how Travis Bickle was on a crusade to, you know, get the scum off the street in 1970s NYC, that's in some ways part of the, you know, toxic matrix that gave us, you know, the president who shall not be named, right? You know, who also made a name for himself going after the Central Park Five, right? And producing this, you know, aggrieved white masculinity. Conversely, Rocky is all about the fantasy of a white boxing champion, right? When there's in which no white man had seized that role. So I think what the curators are getting at there is how film plays such an important role in American life as a kind of, you know, fantasy structure, right? For not just whiteness as it is, but as it imagines itself becoming or having once been.
Oh, excellent. Tyga, before we go, can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book?
Oh, yeah. So my book is not about whiteness.
Wait a second. My next one will be.
I'm sorry. We're out of time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. It's about cinema, though, you know. And actually, I do have a discussion in there of Manderley by Lars von Trier, which is another very interesting avant-garde film about whiteness and a European take on American race relations. So I'm interested in sort of how cinema since the 60s has really become a place where racial meaning can be made and unmade. I guess that would be the shortest way of saying what I'm about in that book.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank
you.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want
to be back anytime and talk about white chicks.
Yes. Oh my God!
Don't tell April that.
Yes, we have
staff picks,
excitement.
So April, that might be
know,
your next
right?
staff pick. All right, Tavia, thank you so much for joining us, man. You take care.
All right, you too. Thanks.
And now it is a time on our show where we give out our staff picks. Every week, we ask the panel to tell us about a movie we think folks should check out. Any movie at all, April? How about I start with you?
Okay, so I'm keeping with the theme today.
Musical or cracker?
No. Kind of cracker, but it's actually explores white identity in two different ways. We're talking about like very kind of Nordic, you know, Swedish white identity versus the ethnic identity of Montenegro, and both white.
Mamma Mia, here we go again.
Both white, but it's a movie called Montenegro, and it is one of my favorite films. And it stars Susan Anspaugh as an American woman married to a Swedish man. And he's just kind of like, he's stepping out on her and she's just kind of like losing her mind. You know, it's random tiny things where she'll just like make food and then put it in the trash. You know, like what's going on with this woman? Because she's kind of like a bored housewife. And she goes to the airport to try to, like, follow her husband on his business trip and ends up kind of getting caught up with these people from Montenegro who, like, take her to their kind of gypsy camp with a strip club, and she kind of learns to be herself. There's pitchfork fights. It's just like there's tons of rampant drinking. There's one of the weirdest motorized dildo scenes you'll ever see in a movie.
As opposed to all those run-of-the-mill ones.
Yeah.
So tired of already.
It is so funny and so weird, and it is just different kinds of whiteness on display in the way that people kind of interact with that. It's one of my favorite movies that has, I think, one of my favorite endings. I have a poster of the ending of the movie because it's just so wonderful and dark. It's so dark. But ABBA plays in one of the weirdest scenes. It's the song that goes like, I do, I do, I do, I do. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, it's called I Do, I Do, I Do.
I was assuming it was that. But it was like, the husband is hanging out with his mistress and dancing around in like a white robe with like another man who like it may be a threesome, but you're not sure. It's just kind of like this weird debauchery that they're having while ABBA's playing. And then meanwhile, that woman is like getting fought over with pitchforks in an alley. I love that movie so much. Montenegro.
All right. Right. And also, just in that little bit right there, you have an amazing singing voice. And that little, I do, I do, I do. I was like, oh, damn, look at April. Holy shit.
Choir.
I love saying the director's name, Dujan Makaveyev.
Yes, Dujan Makaveyev. And he's had, like, he's got a few movies that
W.R.
I just, like,
Mysteries of the Organism.
Yeah, I really enjoy his work. But this one is one that really spoke to me. So, Montenegro.
That's right. What's up. Alonzo, what do you got for us?
Dave White and I played I Do, I Do, I Do, I Do, I Do at our wedding, which might have been
no
a little on the nose,
way.
But
really?
We did.
That's so great.
It's what we exited to. My pick this week is a movie that I saw at Outfest for the first time. It is a 1985 queer film that has been very much out of circulation, and it was, in fact, the very first feature film about AIDS. It's a drama called Buddies from a filmmaker named Arthur J. Bresson Jr., whose career spanned everything from documentary to gay porn. And this is a drama about two New Yorkers, one of whom is kind of a yuppie who volunteers to be an AIDS buddy, and then the person to whom he is assigned, who is in the final stages of dealing with HIV. And, you know, the guy who's dying was an activist and very much kind of a rabble rouser and sort of, you know, changes the life of his buddy. And it's just this really fascinating, you know, character study, but also kind of snapshot of New York in the mid 80s. And this is a movie that came out like before ACT UP. And they said, Jenny Olsen at the screening said that it premiered at San Francisco's Frameline Festival. And then 4 days later, Ronald Reagan said the word AIDS in public for the first time.
Oh.
So this was very early in the curve of that stuff, but really kind of brings that back. And I mean, just the opening credits kind of made me start crying because it's just this dot matrix printer running out line after line after line of people's names and deceased AIDS, one after another, after another, after another, just in that unrelenting dot matrix
way.
It's a really powerful film, and I knew it existed, but I'd never seen it. And and Vinegar Syndrome has just done a beautiful 2K restoration. It's now out on Blu-ray. It's not streaming; you have to actually get the Blu-ray. But you know, physical media is awesome. Get one. Yeah. But yeah, Buddies, I really recommend it.
That's what's up.
Okay,
my man Dave.
Hey. Mine is very basic. It's in theaters now, and I'm sure you've talked about it. But it bears repeating. Everybody needs to see Eighth Grade.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. It is just I wrote Bo Burnham off because he began on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I was wrong. I was wrong. Bo, I was wrong. He's an absolute genius. It plays out like a suspense film. I was was really on the edge of my seat, and it's just a beautiful, nice film.
Oh, word.
Yeah.
I didn't really pay too much attention to his like YouTube career, when somebody brought up Eighth Grade last week, I was like, oh yeah, well he just directed Chris Rock special, that Tambourine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I thought, like, I mean, he doesn't do anything like hugely like flashy or anything in it, but that's the thing, like, it's like, oh, you know what you're doing, you know not to just like make it your
stand
special.
Between the audience and the screen waving your arms.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm directing this.
Yeah. Oh, it's just,
you know,
beautiful.
But but it looks great, and everything I've heard about this Eighth Grade has been like, it's top notch.
Everyone should see it.
That's what's up. Well, my pick is one that falls into our theme of whiteness, and we've already talked about several like 80s movies with Tavia. I just went and saw The Lost Boys again at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is a, I mean, as sometimes I poo-poo on them because of their choices, but sometimes they just fucking knock it right out the park. And The Lost Boys was like just so fun to watch in a cemetery. I mean, it's a movie from the 80s. It's like Mamma Mia 2 again, where there is no Santa Clarita, Carol of California, right?
Yes.
There's Santa Clarita.
There's a Santa Clarita, but I think in the movie it's supposed to be something Santa else. Cruz. It's called Santa something. Fictitious. I forget what it's called.
In the movie, it's like maybe Santa Clarita is the real one that it's based off of.
Yeah.
When I was yelling earlier about how Mamma Mia, like, how are you going to have to make up another white spot? I was like, oh, damn, Ricky, we're going to talk about The Lost Boys, and they make up a white spot. So, all right, you know, I'm fine. It's all good.
And you get
it's
a sexy Jamie Gertz.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, this is where I fell in love with Jamie Gertz. Sure. So, like, crazy, crazy love. And, oh, an old boy with a saxophone. I mean, that's saxophone dude.
Honestly, the way that my best friend from high school and I sort like when we were a little bit sort of coming out to each other, one of the first things, and he said it to me in the middle of that movie, was Jason Patrick looks really good in flannel. Because he really does.
Yeah, I was saying, if you want to study like the male gaze of gay directors, look no further than how Joel Schumacher shoots Jason Patrick in this movie. Although making him eerily look like Rob Lowe at certain times,
he does.
White Varnay sunglasses, especially,
it's very St. Emil's Fire Rob Lowe, absolutely,
which is another Schumacher joint.
It is another Schumacher joint.
He's
Damn.
Got a type.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'll tell you, to get him at his male gaziest, Colin Farrell in Tigerland.
Oh, I've never seen Tigerland.
He all but, like, sexually harasses him with the camera.
Wow. I'm a fan of the other Joel Schumacher, Colin Farrell joint, is Phone Booth.
Oh, right.
Also with Kiefer Sutherland.
I was
Sutherland.
Just looking at that earlier
today.
Yes,
but that's the one where Colin Farrell has a shirt on. It's less interesting than Tigerland.
Yeah, because that's Cohen.
Larry dude. Cohen, yeah.
Larry Cohen, yeah. Who's got a... There's a documentary about him out.
Yes, I want to see that.
It's not shot that well, but the director is a great interviewer. Documentary directors need to know how to interview people, and it's a skill that most of them don't have. Mm. That King Cohen, actually, he does know how to interview people.
Okay, all right. Well, next week we'll be talking about Mission Impossible Fallout. Hey, if you like what you're hearing, you want to leave us that good review on Apple Podcasts, y'all, please do, because 5-star reviews get a shout-out on the show. Oh, let's start off with Daniel 8383. He says, I came to this pod as a fan of the brilliant and, is it erudite?
Erudite.
Alonzo Duralde.
I've been
a fan since hearing about him from the wonderful Louis Vittel years ago. All the co-hosts are great. I've been reading April Wolf's enlightening articles in the late LA Weekly for years, but didn't know she was so funny. I didn't know Ricky Carmona before this, but his enthusiasm and humor quickly made him one of my favorite personalities. The revolving supporting cast is also great fun. Drea Clark's wacky neighbor. And Ingo King's nemesis are always welcome. This is a great dive into movies and issues done with energy and humor. It's become one of my weekly staples. Thank you, Daniel 8383. Avery, you want to read this next one?
Sure. T. Dickinson says, I love the show. When I saw Ricky and April introducing a screening of MacGruber at Max FunCon East 2017, I knew the show was going to be something special, and it does not disappoint. Ricky, April, and Alonzo have fast become one of my favorite podcasting trios, and the addition of great guests like Drea or Inku just ups the game even more. I want to tell them all that my name is Tom.
Yeah, you do.
Hi, Tom.
That's what's up.
Molly Rickmer says, I was missing my weekly dose of Ricky Carmona after the end of Wham Bam Pow and was so excited to find him on a brand new movie podcast. His exuberant energy never fails to make me smile. Co-hosts April Wolf and Alonzo Duralde are absolute gems, as are frequent guests Drea Clark and Ingo Kang. I found a lot of great new movies from the team's staff picks and have avoided a few bombs by listening to their reviews in advance. I listen to about a million podcasts, and this is possibly my most favorite. I can't wait to see it pop up in my queue every week. Heart emoji.
Thank you, guys. Thank y'all. Dave, thank you, sir.
Thanks all
here,
y'all.
Man. Thank you very much for being here.
Certainly.
Where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Dave Holmes until I burn it all down. But
take
now,
it all.
I'm there.
You've got like a week, guys.
Yeah.
Can you tell us real quick about your podcast? I did not introduce you with that early on. Is it Homophilia? Yes, please.
It is me and my friend Matt McConkey, who's a writer on Heathers, and a very funny guy. And we sit down with awesome LGBT people and talk about their lives and what they're watching, and who they love in.
Word. Yeah. That's what's up.
We get deep into it. We just had Dan Savage the other day.
Oh, nice.
We got deep, y'all. We got deep. And we're doing it up in Montreal for the Just for Laughs Festival with a special guest who I cannot reveal.
Okay. All right. Can you tell us afterwards who it is?
Maybe.
All right. Excellent. Hey, this Monday, July 30th, we'll be releasing the audio of our live show from the Dynasty Typewriter where we discussed Attack the Block. If you're subscribed to the show, it's just going to show up in your feed, so look out for that. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYouPod. Send us an email at WhoShotYouMaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org, and that's what's up.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.